going to pick up here in Baptist history. We're looking at little glimpses of groups and people and how they were persecuted because they attempted to live and die by the Bible. So 1525, the radical Anabaptists' Bible meetings and anti-pedo-Baptist views were condemned by a guy named Zwingli and the Zurich, Switzerland City Council. In defiance, on the 25th of January, the radicals formed the first congregation of believers through being baptized. So here's most people, to become a member of a church, how did most people, 99.9999% of the people, how did they join the church throughout Europe? How did they normally join the church?
By attending.
We're talking about the majority of all the millions of people who claim to be Christians. They were baptized as a baby. Okay? That, if you were not baptized as a baby, that baby's damned. That baby is lost. That baby will die and go in limbo. It can't even, there's no heaven or hell for the baby. And so they made baptism of babies the prerequisite to become not only a church member, but a citizen of the country. So they were extreme. This we're talking about Lutherans, and almost all the Protestants were that, anti-Bible. So these people, for church membership, said you're going to join the church first by being baptized by adults, getting adults baptized by their own choice. And that was radical. That was unheard of, because your baby baptism, they said, did not count. Number nine, in 1526, a guy named Felix Mantz. Felix. M-A-N-T-Z. Felix Mantz. He was drowned in Zurich for violating the magistrate's order against rebaptizing. Just the fact that he was getting somebody rebaptized. As he came down from the Wellenberg to the fish market, says Bullinger, and was led through the shambles to the boat, he praised God that he was about to die for the truth. Man, would you do that? And you'd be going, this is not fair, let me go, I want to go to my wife and kids. No, he said, thank God I'm about to die for the truth. 1529, Annika of Freiburg, a Christian woman, was drowned and her body was afterwards burnt for violating Zurich's magistrate order against rebaptizing, because she was rebaptized. Louis Hetzer, another Baptist minister, was beheaded at Constance on the 4th of February. He also had been on intimate terms with Zwingli, Nicola Pettis, and their associates, and was highly esteemed by them till he became a Baptist, and then he became their enemy. In 1530, the persecution was so fierce in Germany and Switzerland that there seemed to be no safety but in emigration. The only way that they were able to survive was if they left. So many thousands of Baptists, inhabitants of the Tyrol, Switzerland, Austria, Styria, and Bavaria, emigrated under the leadership of Jacob Hutter, and they settled in Moravia. In 1535, Ferdinand, King of Bohemia, ordered the expulsion of the Baptists from Moravia, and sent a military force to carry the order into effect. Their property was seized, and all the indulgence they could contain was liberty to carry away their movables, meaning that the only thing they were allowed to do was carry what they could take away with them. They withdrew into the forest and there lived as they could. They worshipped God and possessed their souls in patience. Hutter exhorted and comforted them as the preacher, and he said, be thankful unto God that ye are counted worthy to suffer persecutions and cruel exile for Jesus' name. That's how they viewed persecution. Just because they weren't going to baptize their babies and they were going to live by the Bible. 1537, a guy named Menno Simons, M-E-N-N-O-S-I-M-O-N-S, Menno Simons, he became leader of the Dutch Anabaptists. And we'll talk about him more later. Massive religion. In 1538, religious, massive religious and government efforts were made to expel all Anabaptists from England. In 1547, King Edward issued a commission to Archbishop to search after all Baptists, go after the Baptists. And under that condition, the celebrated Joan of Kent, who was a Baptist, was burnt on May the 2nd. Several others shared the same fate. 1575, the 17th year of Queen Elizabeth's reign, a congregation of Baptists was found outside Aldgate, London, of whom some were banished. 27 were immediately imprisoned, and 2 were burnt to death in Smithfield. John Fox, the celebrated author of Fox's Book of Martyrs, penned a most eloquent letter to the Queen on their behalf, but he did it in vain. So the truth is that there were people that were being persecuted, and other people were coming to their aid and not stopping the persecution. In 1576, a royal proclamation was issued in which it was ordained that all Baptists and all other heretics should leave England, leave the land. But they seemed to gather fortitude, for some formed themselves into new separate societies. Hans Nadis in 1598, the notable English Baptist whose ministry in the 1600s was characterized by preaching, by writing, by frequent incarceration. Who in the Bible was frequently put in jail and in prison?
Is that in the Old Testament?
There are several. So think of just the New Testament for the moment.
Okay, that was John the Baptist.
Okay, excellent. He was in prison for preaching. Who else?
That was Paul.
Good. So we've got John the Baptist. He was put into prison. We've got the Apostle Paul. He was frequently put in prison. There's a guy named the Apostle John. He was imprisoned on the Isle of Patmos. Okay, so it was normal. How about in the Old Testament?
Was that Elijah?
No. But Jeremiah was. He was put in prison. He actually put in the bottom of a hole, a well. Jeremiah, there was another prophet named Micaiah. Not sure if I'm spelling his name. I thought it was AIA. Micaiah was put in prison, and that's how you spell it now. So most of the prophets, anybody who stood for the truth, always had in trouble. So now I don't get in trouble. I don't want to go to jail, but it's coming to there, isn't it? It's coming to that point. Hans Nadis, the notable English Baptist whose ministry in the 1600s was characterized by preaching, writing, frequent incarceration, and firm Baptist principles. He preached both in England and New England and America alike, as crowds of over 1,000 people were said to gather at his London home. Cathcart said, a historian said, he was regarded and he is still revered as a shining light by the denomination whose name he honored and whose bounds he extended, talking about Baptists. He died in London in September 1691 in the 93rd year of his age. Leonard Busher, 1614. Mark Leonard Busher is one of history's most important figures in the struggle for complete religious liberty. You need to know that name. It's a name that nobody knows about, but it's something to know. A confederate in fellowship among the likes of Smith, which we're going to learn about in a few minutes, Smith starting the first Baptist church, official Baptist church in America, in Helwes. Busher had a heart for freedom, and he wrote the earliest known tract in the English language in defense of soul liberty. So, do you remember what soul liberty means? It's a Bible doctrine, but Baptists make big of it. Soul liberty means that your conscience, as you read the Bible, is free to decide what you believe. You have the liberty to believe that we're all aliens. I don't care. I cannot impose my faith on you. That's soul liberty. you're welcome to believe whatever you want. So that means that Baptists have always been for freedom of Jehovah's Witnesses to believe what they want to believe. Catholics, you want to believe what you want to believe? Fine. Just don't kill us Baptists. And don't kill Jehovah's Witnesses. Don't persecute those who don't believe like you. Soul liberty is the foundation of biblical Christianity. Christians don't destroy or fight or kill heretics. We may rebuke them. We may tell them they're wrong. But they have the freedom to be wrong. Okay? So that's soul liberty. Now, if you've grown up in one church, say your country was just one church. Now, from Nigeria, your area is mainly Pentecostal, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so if a Baptist came in and everybody there was Pentecostal, guess what all the Pentecostals thought? We need to get rid of that Baptist. But you see, Baptists would say, no, you're free to believe what you want. We believe in soul liberty. A lot of other churches don't. They want to get rid of them. And that's not Christianity. So, he was a friend of John Smith, we'll see about in a minute, and Helvis. He had a heart for freedom. He wrote there in his own tract, and the tract was entitled Religious Peace, a Reconciliation Between Princes and Peoples and Nations. He was saying, we can get along, even though people believe differently. And it was revolutionary, because everybody thought we all had to believe the same to get along. Number 21, the line of English churches that can be traced who call themselves Baptists began in 1610. Now that's another thing to highlight and to make sure that you remember. When people start pointing out, well, when did Baptists begin? Well, officially, by name, they started using the name quite proudly in 1610 in Holland. This is not to say there were no Baptists in Britain earlier, but that this began a line of churches whose history can be traced. And it began with a man named John Smith, S-M-Y-T-H, who was an ordained bishop of the Church of England. In 1606, after 9 months of soul-searching and study of the New Testament, he was convinced that doctrines and practices of the Church of England were not biblical, and thus he resigned as a priest, and he left the Protestant Church, the Church of England, we would call the Church of Ireland here. Because of the persecution by the Anglican Church of all who disagreed with it, and those who refused to agree with his authority, John Smith had to flee England. And so he ended up in Holland, in Amsterdam. He and another guy named Thomas Helvis and 36 others formed the first Baptist church of English people known to have stood for baptism of believers only. So Smith believed the only real apostolic succession is the succession of biblical New Testament truth. Not of an outward ordinance and visible organization such as the Church of England or the Roman Church. So this is something very, I say this, and I hope that you understand. I hope I can explain it or illustrate it. But we'll start with Jesus. And he has his apostles and their doctrine. And we'll run through history. Okay? Down to the present day. Okay? Now the question is, I look at all of these different churches, and I'm looking at them, and I'm saying, all right, which one goes all the way back to Jesus? Because that's what everybody asks. They say, which was the right church? So they started looking at it, but this church goes all the way back here, and that's what they do. And it began, like the Mormon church began in 1850 or whatever it was, alright? You look at another church, and the Lutheran church, they began in 1536, something like that, okay? And you find all these things, like, you want to go all the way back. How can I find out if a church is the same as what Jesus and the apostles started? How do I find out?
But preaching was Jesus Christ as the current church.
Good. So if this church is preaching the New Testament only, if any one of these things, doesn't matter if you only go back a little ways and you can't find them for a while, I check the church by the Bible. That's the only way, because the Catholics want to say, We can go all the way back to Peter. Baptists don't believe that. We don't worry about, is this church and then the church that Craig came from, was that a good church? And was the pastor of Craig, did he come from the church that was a good church? That's a good thing, but it's not going to be true. Sometimes churches get formed because somebody says, I'm wrong being in the Church of England. I'm going to start a church now that's just the Bible. And that's what John Smith did, okay? So some people find fault with it, and they go, oh, you don't, your church began in 1610. No, no, no. The church that we formed, the Bible Baptist Church, I founded and formed and taught it to be like Jesus' church. I don't want to be like the Church of Ireland or the Lutherans or anybody else like that. That's where the difference comes in. Number 23. Smith believed the only real apostolic succession is the succession of biblical New Testament truth, as long as that's passed down, and not of outward ordinances and visible organizations such as the Church of England or the Roman Church. He believed the only way to recover the church was to form a new church based on the Bible. He then baptized himself, which is kind of not biblical. You don't baptize yourself. But he did, not knowing what else to do. And he baptized others of his congregation. In only a few years, however, the church had lost all but 10 members to the Mennonites and to other groups in Holland. Smith died in 1612, and the church ended in Holland shortly after that, with Helvis, Thomas, and John Burton returning to England as persecution their lesson. So history records members of this Baptist church, they all went back to England. Those who remained in Holland joined the Mennonite church, Simon. Therefore, the Baptist church in Holland did not produce a succession of other churches, but those who founded it went on to set up other Baptist churches now back in England. All that to say this, no church is perfect, and no church is just, it's the shiny example of whatever. No, the shiny example of what every church is to be like is what the Bible says. I want our church to be light to the world. I would love for our church to be a good example to the world, but our church is full of imperfect people. It has an imperfect pastor. I could disappear, I could have bad health, I could die, I'd be gone tomorrow. The principles, the truths are what make a church, not the people, meaning that, not the pastor, and not the buildings. So this first church in Holland didn't do so well. That's my point, but that doesn't matter. Number 24, back in England, these men formed the first recorded Baptist church on English soil. In 1626, the churches had grown from 1 to 5 churches, and by 1644, there were 40 different congregations. Through preaching of the New Testament, the gospel went forth in power, and the Baptist movement grew rapidly. These first Baptist churches formed in England were generally Arminian in theology. Not that they believed all that Jacob Arminius taught, but that they believed that all men can be saved. So, do you know what is the difference? At that time, there were different churches, and some of the churches were what is called Calvinistic, and others were called Arminian. Do you remember what those two different viewpoints are? Okay, Jacob Arminius taught that people freely choose to believe. Calvin taught God chooses who believes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm neither. In my study of the Bible, Jacob Arminius, I'm not an Arminian. And I'm definitely not a Calvinist. I don't believe that God just sits up there and he picks and chooses and he condemns. I'm a Bible believer. I do believe John Calvin taught and knew a lot of good stuff. And I agree with a lot of this stuff. Jacob Arminius knew a lot. He was a brilliant man. He was not stupid. And there are things that I believe in Jacob, but I don't agree with all of them. But I do believe that people have to believe. In the act of believing, God doesn't just say, "Oh, I'm going to make you believe." No. So when they talk about the First Baptist churches being Armenian, they just mean that. They went around and they said, "You must be born again. You must repent and believe on the Lord Jesus Christ." Whereas Calvin taught, don't tell people they need to be born again. They'll find their own way because God will make them. Now, I'm being terse, I'm being short with it, but that's exactly what the Baptists were up against. Number 26, another group of Baptists were Calvinistic, or they were called particular Baptists, and they believed in limited atonement. Now, limited atonement means only those that were elect or chosen by God could be saved. Particular Baptists had their beginnings around 1616 when some dissenters left the Church of England and were led by the Reverend Henry Jacob. In 1644, these congregations grew to 7 churches in England. So even at the time of the Baptists really growing, there were differences among Baptists. Some of them were holding to John Calvin, some were holding to Jacob Arminius about the gospel, about how to preach it. 28, about this time, the Puritans were also becoming strong in England. The Puritans were dissenters, arguers with the Church of England. They disagreed. And they wanted to bring reform to the Church of England. They wanted to make the Church of England better. Although they were a great deal more pious or religious than the Church of England, he still practiced most of his beliefs, including infant baptism. And they married the church with the government, with the state. Anyone who differed from the practices of the state church, the Puritan church, they were subject to great persecution. They were still persecuted, whipped, sometimes burned at the stake. Puritans and Baptists alike, to escape persecution, they fled to the New World. What's the New World?
The Western World.
Yeah, they went to America. Okay. Now, there was one man named Hansen. Hanser, H-A-N-S-E-R-E. Hansard Knollys, K-N-O-L-L-E-Y-S. Hansard Knollys. He's an example of these dissenters or disagreeers with the Church of England who had to flee to America. He was a presbyter or an elder and a former deacon of the Anglican Church. He was under deep conviction of the need to preach the New Testament and to follow his example as one's rule of faith. So he refused to wear the robes of his church office, and he refused to let unconverted people take the Lord's Supper. Further, he ignored the reading of the order of service that he was told that he had to read, and simply preached instead the scriptures. To preach the Bible without the rituals of the Church of England was against the civil law, and Knollys joined with other dissenters and they left England. In 1638, he landed in Boston and he settled for a short time in Piscataway. Now, I've been to Piscataway. I know where it is in New Jersey. Piscataway up in New Hampshire. I'm sorry, I was Piscataway, New Jersey. Now, in New Hampshire, which is a state, there he became the pastor of the Puritan Church. The Puritans were in control of all the colonies at that time, those upper colonies, and in fact, had set up an unbiblical theocracy, like Israel, in which the Puritan church governed both secular and religious affairs. Because Knollys refused to baptize infants and preached against it, he was banned from the colony by the famous Puritan governor Cotton Mather. Knollys, after 2 years, returned to England at the request of his father. He became an outspoken separatist or dissenter of the Anglican or the state church. And so in 1645, he's broken from the Church of England, became a Puritan. Now he's broken from the Puritans and he forms a Baptist church in London. You think he's going to be everybody's going to let him go away? No. Shortly after, the Church of England fell from grace when the English monarchs were overthrown and the Presbyterians became the favorite church of the state. And the Presbyterians, who are Calvinists, then took up the persecution of biblical believers and they forbade Knollys from preaching in any of the parish churches. He, however, continued to preach by holding services in his own home. One of the last acts of the Presbyterians before the long parliament in England fell was to pass a law imposing the death penalty on anyone who was caught holding to what they called the 8 errors of doctrine. These doctrines included infant baptism, if they held to that you can't baptize babies. So Knolles was imprisoned many times, and he suffered at the hands of the State Church of England again, and he's only one of many such godly men who would not compromise God's truth. The crime of these men was that they believed the Bible was God's truth, and they rejected the dictates of false churches and men. It's revealed that the Calvinistic Protestant Presbyterians persecuted those who followed the Bible and rejected hierarchy and false teachings, which included Calvinism. So Calvinism was persecuted by the Catholics, but when the Calvinists got in power, they persecuted anybody that was not like them. They did the same persecution towards Baptists. Number 30, William Kiffin.
K-I-F-F-I-N.
And all these names, I'll tell you which ones to worry about. But I'm just trying to get you to know these names. William Kiffin in 1660. Kiffin was not only the pastor of Devonshire Square Church for 60 years, but was very active as a merchant banker as well. Macaulay, another historian, said, "Great as was the authority of John Bunyan among the Baptists, that of William Kiffin was greater." And John Bunyan, do you know what John Bunyan wrote? He wrote a thing called Pilgrim's Progress. And Pilgrim's Progress, you ought to write that up at the top. That is a good book to read. Now, it's hard to read. But maybe you could watch a video first and give you an idea of what actually an older video. But he's writing from prison about the Christian life and how hard it is, and yet how important it is to stay the course. It's called Pilgrim's Progress. And it's brilliant. Only John Bunn could write it. And he was a Baptist. And he was in prison because he was preaching. But there was another guy named William Kiffin who was probably more important than John Bunyan for the Baptist Church. Kiffin used his power to influence, power of influence to help many a persecuted Christian. And he took part in a very publicized debate with a guy named Wayne Feigley in 1642 against baby baptism. Robert Hall, number 31. Robert Hall, H-A-L-L. Jumping ahead to 1764. Hall was the English Baptist who was installed as pastor of the church at Cambridge, where his writing and eloquence became the substance of admiration in the world. He was called the Prince of the Preachers, and Cathcart said, his opinions and sayings were treasured up and quoted as if they had been the utterances of an inspired oracle. He was the greatest preacher that ever used the English tongue, and his words will be read while the language of Britain is spoken. That's what they wrote about. That was a Baptist preacher. And then the greatest preacher, number 32, you need to circle, because this guy you need to know, Charles Spurgeon. Spurgeon, 1834. This giant of an English Baptist preacher needs no introduction to most faithful Christians who've done any history. They know anything about history. His printed works are ubiquitous. They cover everything. His profound and useful quotations were prolific, and his ministry in general was timeless. He is known for pastoring a church that's still there over in London called the Metropolitan Baptist Tabernacle in London. His body of written work is unsurpassed in Christian history. He fought against the dissolution of right principles among his brethren in the famous downgrade controversy, the one that held on to the right principles of government, the right principles of churches, and so on and so forth. His perseverance to write so much, preach so fervently, and labor tirelessly, though suffering with immense physical imposition, is a testimony to the grace of God. Charles Spurgeon is somebody, there are great. Did you ever, there was a book that we had on the table, it was 50 Christians. If 50 important Christians that every Christian should know.
Yeah.
One of them was about. I will look up Charles Spurgeon in there.
Okay.
And all of a sudden you'll realize this was just 150 years ago. The kind of influence that he had as a preacher. Anything that he wrote will help you. He's a great, great. I've got loads of his. Books and things in my library that I've used throughout the years when I've learned so much from him. He's just what they call the Prince of Preachers. He's a great Baptist preacher. Number 33, probably the greatest Baptist missionary is William Carey. William Carey, C-A-R-E-Y. He was a missionary to India.
Irish.
Yeah, there you go. He said this. He said, "Expect great things, attempt great things." He's often called, and here's your statement, the father of modern missions. He helps us understand how to do missions even today. William Carey made a profound contribution to the cause of Christ. He is known for having challenged the Calvinistic voices of his day with the need to publish the gospel in heathen lands. Remember, Calvin taught what? That God chooses who goes in. So why go to the heathen? Obviously, they don't want it. God doesn't want them to believe. And William Carey says, no, they're going to hell. And all of the churches in England, Scotland, Wales, even in America, during Carey's time in the 1700s, they said, so what? And he would go from church to church and plead with the pastors, plead with them. He says, send missionaries. We've got to go. They are perishing. And they said, if God wanted them saved, they would be saved. That's the fruit of Calvinism. Can you see how wrong Calvinism is? And how if our church became Calvinistic, it would die. We don't believe in Calvin. We believe in Jesus. And Jesus said, go! Preach to every creature, didn't he?
Yeah.
Alright. So, number C. At a meeting of Baptist leaders in the late 1700s, a newly ordained minister stood to argue for the value of overseas missions. He was abruptly interrupted by an older minister who said, young man, sit down. You are an enthusiast. When God pleases to convert the heathen, he'll do it without consulting you or me. Which is terrible to say. If God wants him saved, he'll get him saved. Number D. It has been said that while Andrew Fuller held the rope, Carey went down into the well of the foreign mission work. He was responsible for translating the Word of God into so many Indian dialects. So Andrew Fuller was financially helped William Carey get to India so that Carey could preach the gospel. Number 34, John Foster. F-O-S-T-E-R. John Foster. John Foster was saved at the age of 17. He was baptized by the notable Dr. John Fawcett. Foster was trained under Fawcett at England's Bristol Baptist College, where he often availed himself of the library's classics, studying and meditating way into the night. He became well known for his literary prowess. A field of endeavor in which he was unsurpassed. He was a brilliant mind. Cathcart said, no man of culture and means reckons his library complete without the works of John Foster, because John Foster was a Baptist who loved the Bible and taught the Bible, and people relied on his teaching. Now, my favorite missionary, you better know this name. Do you know who my favorite missionary is?
No.
Okay, here's the name. All right, number 35. It's an unusual name. It's actually a name related to God, but it's Adoniram. Adonai? Okay, I found out there's an AI in there, and I forget. No, it's just I. Adoniram Judson. J-U-D-S-O-N. Adoniram Judson. It's actually underneath the next line, has his name. Adoniram Johnson was America's first foreign missionary. At first, there were people in America that were starting churches and preaching the gospel to the American Indians. Nobody had gone from America to another country. So Adoniram Johnson was the first one to leave America and go to another country. First foreign missionary, B. Adoniram Johnson, Jr., was an American Congregationalist. Again, one of these churches down the bottom. A Congregationalist. Alright, so you know the word congregation in there? Alright. Congregationalist. Alright, that word congregation means that I have similar doctrines to a congregationalist because I believe in the authority of the congregation, not just of the pastor. Okay? We don't have a pope, priests, bishops, what we do, but he's the pastor, but we don't have all the things that we call a hierarchy. We believe the power is in the people. We believe from the Bible that Jesus said, you have one master, and ye are brethren. So, that's where he was a congregationalist. But the congregationalists still baptize babies. He was a congregation, and he later became a Baptist missionary who served in Burma, B-U-R-M-A, for almost 40 years. He served in Burma, B-U-R-M-A. At the age of 25, Adoniram Judson became the first Protestant missionary sent from North America to preach in Burma. His mission and work with Luther Rice led to the formation of the First Baptist Association of America to support missionaries. So he got a lot of people to start supporting missionaries. The Judsons arrived first in Calcutta, India, in June 17, 1812. While aboard the ship en route to India, he did a focused study. He was asked to prove that babies could be baptized and should be baptized. And so he studied the theology of baptism. And he came to the position that the only believer's baptism was theologically valid, and only believer baptism should be done as a matter of obedience to the command of Jesus. So, on September 6th, while in the boat on his way to India, he switched to becoming a Baptist. He switched to the Baptist denomination along with his wife, and they were baptized by immersion in Calcutta, India, by an English missionary associate of William Carey. This guy named William Ward baptized them. Both the local and the British authorities did not want Americans evangelizing Hindus in the area. So the group of missionaries separated and sought other mission fields. They were ordered out of India by the British East India Company, to whom the American missionaries were even less welcome than British. Now, they were baptized in September, and already in June, the United States already was at war with England in 1812. The following year, in 1813, he moved to Burma, and en route, his wife miscarried their first child aboard ship. Judson offered to Baptists in the United States to serve as their missionary. He offered to the Baptists in America, he said, I'll be your first missionary. He stopped being a congregationalist, and he had no money. He said, I'm a Baptist now. And he says, I'll be your missionary if you'll support me. So Luther Rice, who also had converted, was in poor health, and he, who had been with Adoniram Judson, he went back to America, where his work and William Carey's urging resulted in 1814 the formation of the first American Baptist denomination in the United States for foreign missions, called the Triennial Convention, and its offshoot, the American Baptist Missionary Union. They were starting ways of raising money for missionaries. It was another difficult year before the Judsons finally reached their intended destination, Burma. Buddhist Burma, Judson was told by the Saramapora Baptist, was impermeable. It was impossible to get into by Christian evangelism. Now Judson, who already knew Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, immediately began studying the Burmese grammar. Now I have a Burmese Bible. You know what the Burmese language looks like? Okay. This is what it looks like. It's just squiggly lines. It's incredible. And he began. It took him 7 years under a tutor who sat there and tried to teach him before he was able to speak his first sentence in Burmese and write Burmese. So anyway, it took over 3 years to learn to speak it. And that was due in part to the radical difference in structure between Burmese to that of Western languages. And he found a tutor, and he spent 12 hours per day studying the language. And he and his wife firmly dedicated themselves to understanding Burmese. It took Judson 12 years to make 18 converts. It took him 7 to get his first convert. Nevertheless, there was much to encourage him. In those 12 years, he wrote a grammar of the language that is still in use today. And he had begun to translate the Bible. When Judson began his mission in Burma, he set a goal of translating the Bible and founding a church of 100 members before his death. By the time of his death, he had accomplished those goals and more, leaving the translated Bible, which he finished, as well as a half-completed Burmese English dictionary, which we'll talk about in a minute. He left 100 churches before his death, and over 8,000 believers. He was looking to have just 100 believers. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
In large part, due to his influence, Myanmar, which is Burma, has the third largest number of Baptists worldwide, behind the United States and India. The majority of adherents are Karen and Kachin people. Judson compiled the first ever Burmese English dictionary, and missionary E.A. Stephen completed the English Burmese half. Every dictionary and grammar written in Burma in the last two centuries has been based on the ones originally created by Judson. Judson became a symbol of the preeminence of Bible translation for Protestant missionaries. In the 1950s, Burma's Buddhist Prime Minister, U Nu, told the Burman Christian Council, "Oh no, a new translation is not necessary. Judson captures the language and idiom of Burmese perfectly and is very clear and understandable. So his translation of 150 years ago, or 200 years ago, remains the most popular version still in Myanmar today. Each July, Baptist churches in Myanmar celebrate Judson Day, commemorating his arrival as a missionary. And inside the campus of Yangon University is Judson Church, named in his honor. And in 1920, Judson College, named in his honor, merged into Rangoon College, which has since been renamed Yangon University. And the American university named in his honor, Judson University, was founded in Elgin, Illinois. So they named the college over there after him in 1963 as the liberal arts Judson's College was separated from the Northern Baptist Theological Seminary, which moved from Chicago to Lombard, Illinois. The American Judson College became Judson University and also has a campus in Rockford, Illinois. So there are all these colleges that honor this one Baptist missionary. Judson's change to the validity of believers' baptism and subsequent need of support led to his founding the first national Baptist organization in the United States, and subsequently to all American Baptist associations, including the Southern Baptists, that were the first to break off from the national organization of the other churches. The publication of his wife Anne's letters about their mission inspired many Americans to become or support Christian missionaries. It's just, in the next time I teach this, I will actually expand. There is so much about Adoniram Judson. He's my hero. I wish I could give you, he lost his first wife. He lost several of his children to disease, and yet he kept going. He was put in a hole, and he was left there for, I don't remember how many years, by the Burmese, because he was not Burmese. They called him British. He was accused of being a spy, even though he was American. But they called him a spy, and his wife would come to him. And there's a little hole in the ground that she would hand him a bit of food once a week. And the only thing he had was a pillow. But in that pillow were pages. So his wife would come and, "Can I swap pillows with him?" And she would give him a pillow. And in the pillow would be a portion of scripture and some pages. He had memorized the grammar, the dictionary, the Burmese. And he had the King James Bible. And he would translate in that little bit of light. And he would put in his pillow and sleep on it at night. It was all crumpled. But after a couple of weeks, he would fill it up, and he would swap the pillow with his wife, and his wife would take it back, straighten out the pages, and would prepare a Bible. And that Bible that he translated in a hole in the ground over years is the Bible that's still used in Burma. Two more moving through for tonight. We'll just read Andrew Weber. Andrew W-I-B-E-R-G is the second name. Andrew Weberg. He was saved while attending the university at Uppsala, and Weberg was converted and later set aside for the priesthood in the state church. Over time, his sincerity led him to question the propriety of admitting the lost to the Lord's table. causing him to leave his work as priest for a season. This is of the Church of England. He eventually met the great German Baptist Anken in Hamburg, and Wiberg became a faithful, persecuted Baptist preacher in Sweden. It was said that his little one became a thousand, which means his influence. Concerning Wiberg's work, Cathcart said the Baptists in Sweden number about 20,000, and still the work goes steadily and hopefully on. To have been a co-worker with God and bringing about such results might well gratify the desires of any large-hearted Christian. Andrew Wiberg ended up getting about 20,000 saved and baptized in Baptist churches. Number 37, President Francis Wayland. Wayland. Francis, your son, Wayland, 1796. Cathcart said of Wayland, the trait which towered above all else was his profound and unwavering devotion to duty. In the just and striking words of his pupil and successor, President E.G. Robertson said, to him, ought and ought not were the most potent words that could be spoken. A sound preacher, a prolific author, and the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Boston and Providence, Rhode Island, and he was the president of a very well-known university called Brown University. His most distinguishing work gave his life, was that he gave his life to the advancement of human beings by encouraging duty and exalting right principles, and his books are inestimable. Now, all of those names may not mean hardly anything to you, and they don't mean much to anybody else, but they are famous Baptist preachers, most of which were persecuted. And I just wanted to throw some of them into the list. And, you know, we talk about founding fathers of a country, but there are people in the history of the freedom that we have as Baptists that you look and you go, these people influenced Queen Elizabeth. Charles Spurgeon influenced Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth. They influenced kings and queens. Baptist preachers stood and preached for freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, not freedom to sin, like what they preach now on television. They go, I want to be free to do whatever I want, but freedom of conscience when it came to worship. And Baptists are different by nature. So, all right, we'll talk about Baptists in America next. Got any questions?
There's not a question, but it seems to me that far more people are killed in England, missionaries, than anywhere else?
Mm-hmm. No, it's much more dangerous to be any kind of Christian anywhere else. So, Christianity really took off in Europe, but at the same time, the devil stirred up what we call state churches, and they persecuted believers. And so, because they did, they were hurting our own. And so, because so many people were preaching, and so many people were getting saved in Europe, there was persecution. But nothing like when Christians went, like you've been to Saudi Arabia. Just imagine, if I came to Saudi Arabia and tried to start a Baptist church, they would put on the next plane and send me home. And if it was 100 years ago, they would kill me. Okay. So it was even more dangerous to try to do it in most of the rest of the world. Missionaries tried. Missionaries have gone to the world all the time, and they usually die. But that's what we do. It's just a whole lot easier to do it in Europe. And everybody who did it in Europe, they were usually doing it to win their own people. But it's, I think it's a higher calling to go win somebody who's not like you. Yeah. And to go and be a missionary in Bulgaria, or Kenya, or Myanmar, or whatever. So, no, it's usually much more dangerous.
Yeah, especially those who does not compromise with the state-owned charges.
Yeah, there was not. No. England's got a lot of blood on their hands. Yeah. They produced a great Bible. They taught a lot of people the Bible. They broke free from Rome. But they did not stay by the Bible. And that's true with anybody. You better stay with the Bible. Thank you.